freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Judy Rebick is a well-known social activist, writer, broadcaster, teacher, speaker, and very proud feminist. Or some of you first met Judy in your living rooms when she was the co-host of a primetime debate show called Face Off on CBC News World from 1994 to 1998. In 2001, she helped launch Rabble.ca, a multimedia independent news and discussion site. Her latest book, Transforming Power, From the Personal to the Political, it focuses on the emerging possibilities for participatory democracy. It is the result of Judy's travels around the world looking for new approaches to political and social action and her lifetime of experience as an activist. She hopes it will inspire dialogue and action about the new path to social change that we need to transform and create a better world. After the failure of last year's Copenhagen meeting on climate change, 30,000 people from over 100 countries gathered in Bolivia for a people's conference to define strategies for action and mobilization to defend life from climate change and defend Mother Earth's rights. She's now devoted her time as a result of the conference to building this mass democratic people's movement on climate change. To speak on transforming power, effective collective action for the planet, please join me in welcoming Ms. Judy Rebick.
I'm very happy to be here. I am always glad to come to Hamilton, although the traffic is worse than it used to be. I'm very happy to be here at the Red Hill Valley Lecture because one of the things, really what I'm talking about here is sometimes when something looks like a failure, it's really a success. Maybe that was true of your struggle around Red Hill Valley because even though you didn't succeed in stopping the throughway, you did succeed in building a really strong environmental movement in Hamilton. And that's often the way that it is with struggles. But now we're faced with a struggle which we don't have that kind of time. I wanted to talk about this because if you just rely on mainstream media for your information, you'd think that the struggle for climate change is kind of over. Copenhagen, nothing was achieved, and now it's dead, and, you know, the Tea Party's getting elected in the States, and we've got Stephen Harper here, and we can barely, we're in a position where we're fighting for our most basic rights, and how can we organize to stop the pollution of the planet? The corporate elite seems to have a lock on power, and I think that's not the whole truth. That's part of the truth. So what I want to focus on here tonight is to talk to you about the rest of the truth, the other things that are happening that are not so visible, but actually you know about them because they're happening in this community. It's just that we don't see how what's happening in our community is actually happening in communities all over the world and how they're starting to come together. And that's something very powerful. And the example I give is the women's movement, because what we're doing, what's happening now is a powerful global movement for Mother Earth. I like that better than against climate change, because it is against climate change, but it's for the protection of Mother Earth and all of its creatures, including its human creatures. And so I think that's what the struggle that we're in is about, and it's a very powerful movement that's emerging. And I want to give the example of the women's movement, because this is a demonstration from Copenhagen. And if you read the mainstream media on Copenhagen, the news is that nothing was achieved. Or this, 28 countries signed this agreement that wasn't much of anything, if you're an environmentalist, and it was a failure and nothing else happened. But what we didn't hear, unless you listen to Democracy Now! Or read Rabble or one of the other alternate media, or you know somebody who went, is that outside the meeting, and some to a certain extent inside the meeting, something else was happening. And that is the powerful global justice movement, or what we used to call the anti-globalization movement, which didn't get hit quite so hard by 9/11 in Europe as it did here. It continued to organize, continued to grow, and we see some of the results of that in the resistance to austerity measures in France today and in Greece. so that the left in Europe didn't get hit quite as hard as we did after 9/11 and by the whole anti-terrorism narrative. That powerful global justice movement came together with the environmental movement at Copenhagen. And even more powerfully, it came together under the leadership of indigenous people, a global indigenous movement, which I'll talk about in a moment. But before I talk about it, I want to talk about what we need to face the crisis of the planet Earth, to overcome the crisis that we're facing. And that is, right here, we need a system change. We need a change on every level of our society. And, you know, when you say that, you think, oh, we can never do that. I'm just going to go home and, you know, I'll put up a solar panel, okay? I mean, but it's too much to think about this. It gives me a headache, you know? So I want to talk about the women's movement because, well, there's some, quite a few people here, I guess, who remember it. But, but you know, when I was in high school, I wasn't allowed to wear pants to school. I had to wear, does anybody remember Lyle stockings? I had to wear, so my legs wouldn't freeze. I mean, one of my strongest memories from childhood was my legs freezing because I couldn't wear pants in the winter. To school, I couldn't wear pants, okay? And not only that, but I was told that women were, when we did go to university, many of us, but it was to find a husband. And that the only ambition I should have in my life is to get married, find a good man, and get married and have kids. You know, and, well, you went to university because you had a better chance of meeting a good man at university. Good provider was the term. Well, I didn't much really like that idea. And so I grew up thinking that I wanted to be like the guys because other women weren't like me. There weren't other women like me. All the women that I knew were married with children, and they weren't working outside the home, and they thought that was okay. But I didn't think it was okay, so I figured I'd be like the guys. That's how I was going to grow up, like a guy. Because it seemed to me the guys had everything. They had money, they had power, they had jobs, they had interesting things to do. And there's no way I wanted to be, and this is a lot of women from my generation, like my mother. Although in retrospect, I'd much rather be like my mother than my father, but at the time, I wanted to be powerful like my father. And I say this because it's important to understand the revolution that the women's movement made. And when we started, there was just a lot of women around like me, right, in the early 60s. And if you watch Mad Men, you see it there. There were women, individuals, who just wouldn't accept the restrictions that were on us, you know, who were rebelling against it, who were fighting it. And there were a few women who had actually managed to break through, you know, the Doris Andersons, who actually refused to give up their job when they got pregnant and had enough power, social power, that they could do it. But most of us were just individuals who just didn't like what was set out for us. And we decided to change it. And then a movement arose. It wasn't the women's movement at first. It was a movement of young people who didn't like the moral restrictions, who didn't like the fact that at universities, students had no say, who didn't like the war in Vietnam, and they who didn't like the fact that blacks were discriminated against in the southern United States, and they started to organize based on what they had learned from the civil rights movement. And then women were part of that, and then the women thought, wait a minute, like how come there's no women leading, well, very few, maybe one or two, no women leading this, and how come I'm getting to make the coffee and run? We didn't have call display or anything. So, you know, like a Model T Ford, okay? So, And so the women's movement started with a bunch of individual people, not unlike what we have today. We have an environmental movement. We didn't have a women's movement really then, yet. But we had, you know, a lot of individuals that didn't like the way things were. Like we have now. We have a lot of individuals who are going to buy organic food, who are going to buy local food, who are changing their light bulbs, who are using who are recycling, who are trying to cut down how much they use the car, or cut down, ride a bike, which, you know, in Toronto, people have to take their life in their hands to ride a bike, especially now. The mayor's going to come around and strike us down, you know. So I say this because, and I'm not going to give a speech about the women's movement, but what I want to say is that we revolutionized, we haven't gone all the way, we haven't reached equality, but we have revolutionized the status of women, not just in our society, but in the world, okay? And I'll talk a bit about that later. And women have become agents in the society, and that's important for this struggle too. Women have become agents, not subjects, not objects anymore, but agents, active in the way that societies run. We're not equal at all levels, and I'm starting to think maybe that's not so bad. Maybe we don't want to be, successful on Bay Street, you know? Like, maybe women really don't get that much of a kick out of gambling and making a lot of money on Bay Street. Maybe that's not so bad. Maybe the values on Bay Street are ones that we reject. I don't know. What I'm proposing to you is that that kind of societal transformation, and maybe more so, is what we're facing now. And for that change to happen, politicians can't make changes like that. Politicians did not change the status of women in Canada. There was the odd one like Judy LaMarche, who was the only woman in Pearson's cabinet. Just like there's the odd one now that actually sees what's needed to fight for climate justice. But the system, the political system, is not designed to make radical changes unless, you know, there's a revolution, and that's not going to happen. Or the revolution, the old sense of the word, the Russian revolution. So the first thing it's important to note in the story that I'm going to tell about this global movement and what's happened in the last year, about what's happened to create this global movement. And the first thing is this merge of the environmental movement and the social justice movement under the leadership of indigenous people at Copenhagen, calling itself an environmental justice movement. And the slogan that came out of Copenhagen, didn't start with the slogan, was system change, not climate change. System change. That we can't just twig this and twig that and change our light bulbs, and that's going to solve it. It's not going to solve it. We have to change the very way that we live. And we have to change the systems that have created climate crisis. Capitalism, patriarchy, and colonialism. Because not just capitalism that created this climate crisis. You know, you could have, I guess, in some other reality, some alter reality, a system that was based on profit, but that didn't believe that one small group of people in the world knew everything and imposed it on everybody else, including slaughtering people to do it, the way that European Western philosophy and politics believes that it is the ultimate, our ultimate great system, and imposed on first through colonialism and then through imperialism and now through free trade, whatever we want to call the system we have now. Or, as I like Pierre Elliott Trudeau's name, savage capitalism. So first we have a movement that's shifted in a very fundamental way, the environmental movement, from saying what we need is environmental sustainability to saying what we need is a system change to deal with climate crisis. And by the way, I'm not arguing here. I assume that the audience understands that we're in a serious crisis and that the very survival of humanity and many of the species of animals and plants are at stake. The native people say Mother Earth will survive. That is not a question. The question is whether humanity will survive. So, and you may not believe that that's true, but and I didn't for a long time, but I'm sure we all believe that the crisis is very serious and that climate change is approaching the point of no return when we won't be able to do anything about it if we don't do something very soon. So one of the things that's happened over the last few years, totally under most people's radar, is that a global indigenous movement has emerged. A global movement of indigenous peoples from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, from North America, has come together. It came together first to support the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which if you haven't read it, you should read it. You can find it online. It's easy to find it. Of course, Canada hasn't signed it yet. One of the few countries, Canada and the United States, still haven't signed it. But it's an astonishing document in terms of the direction that I think not just the direction that Indigenous people need to take, but that the world needs to take. And one of the central experiences of Indigenous peoples all over the world is that they understand that humans are part of nature. Now, it seems kind of simple idea that humans are part of nature, that we are one creature of nature, that not that has the ability to exploit nature, which is the European idea, that our power and the idea of capitalism, our power is in the exploitation of nature, but rather as conscious beings, as the most conscious beings in nature, that our job is to be responsible, to be defenders, of the land, to be protectors of Mother Earth, that we have the biggest responsibility of that because we are conscious beings. We are the beings who have consciousness. This is an idea throughout all Indigenous cultures, anyone that I've looked at anyway. And there's something else about Indigenous people, which is they have prophecies. Now, maybe you're probably more into this than I am, if you're from the Unitarian Church or some church, because I've always been very anti-religious, I'd always say I'm not spiritual, I would say, yeah. But Indigenous people have a spirituality that I can relate to better. I'm even getting used to it from other people, too, and learning that there's a lot of wisdom in spirituality that I didn't understand before. And a lot of Indigenous peoples all over the world have prophecies for this time. Now, the ones the New Age, the hippies knew about was the 2012 end of times, you know, so it was like the end of the world. But that's not what the prophecy is. The prophecy is about a crisis out of which will emerge clarity and a spiritual awakening. That's really what the prophecies tend to be. And so we're in that crisis now. And that crisis is a time when Indigenous people, and I've heard this from Indigenous people in Alaska, Latin America, in the States. It's a Lakota prophecy. It's all over the place. And the prophecy is that it's a time when Indigenous people, and in fact, the clearest was told to me by a Coast Salish elder, who told me that their elders, their job was to protect the knowledge from the invaders, and that now is the time to bring it forward. And a lot of Indigenous knowledge, which is being brought forward now, is knowledge that we need to understand to save the planet. I believe that. And so it's very powerful that Indigenous people are now in the lead of a movement for climate justice. Very powerful. Plus, Indigenous people are who lives on what's left of whatever wilderness is left in the world. And so they are literally the defenders of the land, those who choose to do that. So this movement is being led by Indigenous people, and I'll come to Bolivia in a moment. And then there's the new ways of organizing, and I'm not going to get into this more in the discussion period, but the organizing going on online is astonishing. It's not the be-all and the end-all, but allows us to do things we could never do before. And the best example of that is an organization called 350.org, which is an American group that just started last year. And they put up a website last year before Copenhagen with the idea that people around the world should do an action around the idea that carbon emissions had to be brought down to 350 parts per million. If you go to their website, you'll see photographs, amazing, from what people did everywhere in the world, everywhere, China, Africa, everywhere. This time, on 10-10-10, October 10th, 2010, they called for a day of action on climate change in which everyone around the world would do something to improve, to fight climate change, to improve the planet. And they managed to have 7,347 events in 188 countries. And we're talking not just like an event in Kenya, in Nairobi, but all over Africa, in I think all but two states in Africa, in all but two states in China. There were events. There are people all over the world plugged into this network who see themselves as part of a movement for global justice. And the top 10 things were to organize a tree planting, to go solar, to work on a community garden or an organic farm, to go for a bike ride, to harness the wind, to get more efficient, to do a trash cleanup. Not radical things in and of itself, themselves. They're not radical things in and of themselves. You know, it's not confronting the riot police on the streets of Toronto, right? Sorry, I'm a little obsessed with the G20. What is radical is that the people who were doing this on this day felt that they were part of a global movement of people who want to save the planet and who are willing to take action to save the planet. A friend of mine is making a film on the climate justice movement, and he calls it Evolve Love, Love in a Time of Climate Change. And he's asking people, how can we turn the struggle, again, his name is Velcro Ripper, maybe you've seen one of his other films, Fierce Light or Scared Sacred. And this is the third film in the trilogy, and I think it's going to be by far the best film. Amazing film from what I've seen so far. And he asked the question, how can we turn the struggle against climate change into a great love story? And one a scientist answers him by saying, well, in every great love story, there's conflict. There's a separation of the lovers. Every great love story. And he says, and I suppose if we were to talk about what the separation it would be of humanity from the planet Earth, humanity from Mother Earth. I like to use the indigenous term, Mother Earth. And of course, in every great love story, there's conflict, there's separation, and then either they get back together again and live happily ever after, that's our term, or in the case of Romeo and Juliet and those love stories, there's a great tragedy and death. But either way, it's a ride. Either way, it's fun. Either way, it's life-affirming and transforming, which is why we all like to fall in love, even though we know like half the time it's going to turn out to be a disaster, right? Well, I love that metaphor for this struggle. I love that because even if we don't make it, we're going to feel a hell of a lot better that we tried and that we were a part of this magnificent movement of trying to create a positive alternative to the greed and exploitation that we're fighting against. And there's a woman in the film who's part of the 10-10 events who turns to the camera and she says, well, she says, you know, I came out to be part of this, and it feels great. She said, I could stay home and watch TV and get depressed, but I'd rather be here because I feel like I'm doing something to change the world. And that's really important. The other thing that's happening is this global thing, global local. And the tar sands, the best example. The tar sands is a very good example of many things. Of environmental destruction, it's the greatest example because I don't know if anybody's seen Peter Mettler's film about the tar sands, but if you haven't, you have to see it. The destruction of nature is just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. It makes you cry. And if you ever wanted to feel love for Mother Earth, see that film because you'll feel like your heart is broken for what they've done to the earth in those tar sands. And the people who are fighting for a moratorium on tar sands, they're waging an incredible campaign, and we don't even know about it. They never report about it in the papers. I mean, they reported this one with Greenpeace dropping a banner on the tar sands that said tar sands climate change. And the only reason they reported it was because they broke through the security. You know, oh, my God. But it's beautiful what they did. But here's Clayton Thomas Mueller, who's a fantastic young Indigenous organizer and leader who comes from Ottawa and works for the Indigenous Environmental Network. And there he is in England with the tar sands campaign. And they're having huge success in England, stopping companies, getting companies. They're having so much success that they're getting oil companies to agree that they will not use oil from the tar sands. They will not invest in the tar sands. That's how popular opinion is going against the tar sands in England. So that global local thing, and they're bringing, you know, Indigenous people who are sick from Fort McMurray to places like Copenhagen and Britain to tell their stories. And then there's the local struggles, which you're all part of, which are probably the biggest movement that we have now in North America is the food security movement. and in the world, actually, not just in North America. And it is, in a sense, like the women's movement. It's diverse. It's global. It goes everything from landless peasants who are occupying land in Brazil to, I don't know, in the old days we called them petty bourgeois cooks who are doing local food in Toronto in fancy restaurants that charge. The last time I said this, I said charge $50 for a burger, and I got in trouble because they only charge $35. But what I'm saying is that it's a massive movement. And, you know, the old left-right stuff doesn't quite go. Like, there's a guy from Italy who's the head of the slow food movement. And I went to hear him, and I thought this is a guy, you know, he's kind of a, you know, he's a middle-class guy. He's not very radical, you know, like slow food, you know, just like we should eat together. And, you know, we should, you know, like I thought, okay, but I should go because I see this as some kind of movement that I don't understand. So I went. And he was so radical. Like, he was saying, what are the values we have in this society? We value, this is where I got the line about the gamblers. We value gamblers who all they do all day is place bets because it's in the stock market. And these same people who we think are lowlifes if they're at the racetrack, when they're doing it in the stock market, we praise them to the skies and pay them more than anyone. And the person who's growing our food has to scrap and scramble to make a living. He says we have to turn those values upside down. And this guy is not particularly a radical from a left-right point of view. But he goes into food in a serious way. And when you go into food in a serious way, you realize how screwed up our economic system is. They're poisoning ourselves. And now, you know, they have this idea of plastic meat. They're going to manufacture meat in vats. I mean, this is like even the worst science fiction dystopia never thought of this. Somebody thinks they can make a buck doing that. You know, I mean, I much prefer the Star Trek thing where you say, you know, you just pretend that it's something that tastes good. So, like my niece, you know, my niece's daughter, she pretends, you know, here, have some chicken, you know. That kind of thing, that's what the Star Trek idea is. I like that idea, but I'm not going to eat like vats of phony meat. I mean, so as soon as you go into the food system, you have to radicalize because you see what unbridled capitalism does. It doesn't feed people. It destroys the environment. You know, it poisons people, et cetera, et cetera. So the food movement is a very important part of this. Even though they very rarely have demonstrations in North America, they very rarely do the kinds of things we think of as political. But they are creating an alternative food system inside the capitalist system, a social food system inside the capitalist system. Very important. The green jobs movement is a way that the unions have gotten involved in climate justice. And it's growing, the green jobs movement. It's growing, especially in the States. So these local struggles are also part of this global movement. And then the other thing we're seeing, as I mentioned that before, is a convergence of issues. Because of climate change, because of the environmental crisis, because we're facing multiple crises, a food crisis, a climate crisis, an economic crisis, a political crisis. I mean, how else could you explain that Sarah Palin might be the next president of the United States? Not to mention that Stephen Harper is the prime minister of Canada. We're in a terrible political crisis, terrible, and people are voting with their feet by walking away from it, right? So we're facing these multiple crises, and you realize that you can't anymore focus on a single issue. As soon as you go, let's say, you go into environmental issues, you've got to deal with capitalism, you've got to deal with patriarchy, you've got to deal with racism, all of those are involved in creating climate justice. As soon as you go into any issue, you face all the other issues. So there's a convergence, as I said, between the environmental justice movement and the global justice movement, which now we call environmental justice. And there's also a convergence between spirituality and politics. And this is happening in a couple of levels. I know as people who are here who are Unitarians or are in the Unitarian Church, the Unitarians have always been involved in social justice struggle, as have many in the United Church and many other churches. And, of course, there's people involved on the right from a religious perspective as well. But what we're seeing is groups like Buddhist monks, for example, who weren't particularly engaged in politics, who are now because of the level of the crisis. I went to see the Burmese Buddhist monks in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, and they explained how, you know, part of their belief is that they have to do what they call social activity, that it's not enough just to meditate and pray. They have to do social activity. Well, when the Burmese government is slaughtering people, they realized that they had to stand up and speak out about that, because that had to be, that was the way they had to help people, was by protecting them from this repression. And of course, that brought repression down on them, which then made them much more active in the political sphere, even though they say they're not political. They are political in terms of what they're doing. So we see this convergence happening, which is also very powerful. So all of these elements come to the potential for a global movement. But in my book, Transforming Power, I say the problem is we have these, I would say today in the world, there are more people working for a better world, to save the planet, to have a better world in terms of the way people are treated, against poverty, et cetera, than any time in my life. But they don't have political power. They don't seem to have political power. And this is a real problem for people. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, I don't know, but I think that we have to address the question of power. And somehow these groups, they emerge, they do some work, they disappear, they emerge, they do some work, they disappear. And I know there's this theory of rhizomes that they'll come up everywhere and then they'll take over, but it doesn't persuade me. Now, maybe I'll be wrong and that'll happen, and I would be the happiest person on earth if it happened. But I like to think about how are we going to contest power. And I think it's not going to happen in North America that way, because our political system is too rigid and closed. Although I just saw a terrific, and I'm not a member of the Green Party, but I just saw a terrific, terrific statement by Elizabeth May about Cancun, just what we're talking about. And that's why I want to say that this is a radicalizing moment. So Bolivia, I went to Bolivia a couple of years, in 2006. And I went there because a friend of mine convinced me that if I was going to write a book, which is Transforming Power, about new paths to social and political change, that I had to start in Bolivia. Because in Bolivia, what's happening, and that was only 6 months in when I was there, now it's 2.5 years, what's happening is a peaceful revolution based on indigenous wisdom and socialist ideas. That's what's happening there. It's a peaceful revolution. And Bolivia is 70% indigenous people. The indigenous people there have been marginalized. In many ways, the revolution in Bolivia is equivalent to the anti-apartheid revolution in South Africa, where also a majority of people were marginalized. And just the democratic part of the revolution is worthy of attention. It's gotten very little. And that's because the ideas, I think, that the mainstream media shuts out Bolivia because the ideas that they're putting forward are so powerful. And the leader of that revolution is named Evo Morales. I take that picture, which I took myself. Just to say that Evo Morales is very different than most leaders. For example, a few of us, I wasn't able to go, but a few of us were invited to New York to meet with him. And everybody who came back from that meeting said the same thing to me. They said, we went to this meeting with Evo Morales, and he welcomed us, and then he asked us what we thought we could do and our organizations could do to build a global movement for climate justice, and then he listened. They couldn't get over it. Here's the president of a country, and kind of famous, too. And he listened to the grassroots activists. And that's because the way in which they've won in Bolivia, the way in which they continue to win, is by basing themselves on the power, organized power of social, what they call social organization, what we would call social movement. Evo, every time he makes a big decision, he meets with his cabinet, but he also meets with the leaders of the social movements. He sees himself as accountable to those social movements. And he says himself, when we got elected, we didn't take power. It's only one step in taking power. For the people to really be in power means a transformation of the whole society. And that's what the people there are engaged in. They have an idea, which is now taken into the Cochabamba Accord, called living well. And the way they say what living well means is that there's enough resources in the world for everyone to live well, but not for some to live better. And the idea is that everyone should live well. Everyone should have enough to eat, should have a place to live, access to education, right up to post-secondary education, health care, free health care, and the ability to be, the opportunity to be the best that they can be. Everybody in the world should have that. But, you know, people don't need 5 bathrooms and Jaguar cars and, you know, $300 purses and 500 pair of shoes and whatever. I mean, I don't even know anymore. All the, and even us, you know, even us who aren't rich in our society, but we have a lot of stuff. You know, I myself decided to downsize in the last year, and I gave away a lot of my stuff. And it was amazing how much stuff I had. Amazing that I didn't really need. But, you know, we all have this thing, like, we all have this thing that, oh, if I buy this gadget, it's going to make me feel better, you know? Like whenever I feel down, I notice it now, you know? There's 2 things I do. Like I eat a cinnamon bun or I go shopping. Now the cinnamon bun really makes me feel kind of loggy, you know what I mean? Like it's almost instantly making me feel bad, even though I think it's going to make me feel good. The shopping, it lasts about 12 minutes. To make me feel good, you know? So, and of course, all these surveys and so on tell us this is not what makes us happy. What makes us happy is friendship, you know, family, good family, loving relationships. That's what makes us happy. And as that young woman points out in the film, working for a better world makes you happy too. Not all the time, but when it's happening, it does. Okay, so that's the idea of living well. It's a very powerful idea. It's spread through the Latin American left now. And the other thing I want to say about Bolivian values is one of their values is I can only be happy if everyone in my community has what they need. It's kind of the opposite of neoliberalism or corporate capitalism, right? So I like that one too. But it's not just different ideas they have. They're actually creating a new model of development. And in the 2 years they've been in power, they've eliminated illiteracy. I put here literacy, but I should fix that. There's been a 6%. What do you need to read for? You know. A 6% reduction in poverty. They've nationalized hydrocarbons, nationalized electricity, established co-ops throughout the country so that people who are just, you know, selling stuff on the street are able now to actually create small businesses. So they're not ideologues. Like, they're not, like, you know, out with the free market altogether in the like the old days, you know, that the left would do, would just banish the free market. No, they see a role for the free market. You know, people want to make things and sell them, and people want to buy them. There's a role for a free market. But they establish co-ops for that, so that poor people don't have to sell their goods to big corporations who give them 5 cents for it and sell it for $50. And they can decide, in those co-ops, they can decide on how they live themselves. They can decide how much to pay themselves, how much to work, all of that. They've had the first seniors pension in Bolivia, and that's also true in Venezuela. I won't get into Venezuela because we're not talking about that. And a scholarship for school supplies. How am I doing for time? Oh, I better get going. I'll just tell this one story. When I was in Bolivia, I was traveling with my friend Susan Harvey from Cochabamba to La Paz, and this is over mountains, and we got to the highest point. And so we stopped, you know, just so we could say we stopped. I think it was 4,000 meters high. And 3 little kids came down from the mountain top, and a boy, he was about, I'd say he's about 8, and his 2 sisters, maybe 4 and 2, 5 and 2. And we said, you know, I want to take their picture because they were beautiful. And he said, no photo. And so Susan said, would you like some, you know, you want some money? She figured he wanted money for the photo. He says, no, no photo. So Susan asked, what would you like? And he said, a notebook. Because he couldn't go to school because he didn't have a notebook. And he wants to go to school because now Evo Morales is president of Bolivia. And he sees that there's an opportunity for him as an indigenous kid to go to school and maybe become president of Bolivia. But he can't afford a notebook to go to school. And when we told that story to people that we met, they all cried. Because that's what it said to them. It said to them that by Evo being president, now all these little indigenous kids feel they can do something too. They can be somebody too. And so we didn't have a notebook. But we went to La Paz and we bought notebooks and brought them back. But that told me that, you know, that's how poor people are in Bolivia. And so one of the things they did was scholarship for school supplies, for every kid can have school supplies and go to school. One of the lead-ups to Evo Morales winning in Bolivia was the Cochabamba water wars, which you may have heard about because it did come to North America. In 2000, the people of Cochabamba, which is the third largest city in Bolivia, rose up against a proposal to privatize water. This company was so arrogant that they got the government of Bolivia to make it illegal for poor people to gather water on their roof in containers because that would cut into their market. And they're charging so much for water that it was 40% of the income of people, of poor people in Bolivia to pay for water. Like, it was an outrage, and people rose up and they fought and they brought the army in against them, and people were killed and hurt, and they won. They defeated it after a long struggle. They defeated that water privatization, and that's been a beacon in the fight for protecting water from privatization and protecting the rights to water for the whole of the world. And that's why when Evo Morales, after Copenhagen decided to call a world people's summit for climate change last April, he decided to call it in Cochabamba. I knew I shouldn't have had that wine for dinner. In Cochabamba. So it was last April, and these flags that are up here, these are the Wipala, which is the flag of indigenous people in Bolivia. And I'm going fast, so if you want in the discussion period, I'll tell you what it means. It's a square flag, so you can think about it. 35,000 people were in Cochabamba. How many people heard about this? Yeah. 35,000 people. That's a lot more than we're at the Tea Party convention. 35,000 people from 187 countries, and there were 47 government delegation. Because the Bolivian understands the power of social movement, they understood the power of what was happening in Copenhagen in the streets. And so they called this conference to consolidate that network that was building at Copenhagen. And in a very democratic process of consensus in small groups, a People's Assembly, which is being reproduced in Toronto on December 4th, there's going to be a People's Assembly like this one. They came up with a Cochabamba Declaration, which you can find online, and I've just taken out some salient points. The first is the climate justice point. Rich countries are responsible for the destruction of the earth, of the planet. Rich countries are responsible, and therefore they have to pay. And they have to take primary responsibility, and that's climate justice. And poor countries are the ones who are paying the biggest price right now. Because the devastating effects of climate change are already being felt in Bolivia. The glaciers are melting. They're already being felt in the island countries. They're already being felt in the global south. The idea of climate debt, which emerged, Naomi Klein talks about this a lot, which emerged in Copenhagen, is now in the declaration, that rich countries have to pay for poor countries to be able to clean up the environment, and they're proposing 6% of GDP. And when you say to Bolivia, well, that's kind of not very, that's not very realistic. They say that's what these countries pay for defense spending. So move the defense spending into cleaning up the planet. Because what's going to hurt us more? And then there's the new model, the systems change. A new model's needed where humans live in harmony with the natural world, living well, not living better. That's right in the Cochabamba Declaration. Carbon markets and carbon offsetting are rejected. The idea of cap and trade, which is basically the people who caused the problem making money off of it. That's what cap and trade is. The people who caused the problem now get to make money off of it. And of course, on the backs of the global south, because that's where they're going to buy their carbon things. And the increase in, the Kyoto Accord talked about an increase in global temperatures was acceptable of 2%. They don't believe that it is. They think science shows that it shouldn't exceed 1%. This is not my strength.
One degree.
I told you this is not my strength. One degree. And a 50% reduction in emissions by rich countries compared to 1990 levels by 2017. Elizabeth May came out today, or in this statement that I just saw today, I'm not sure if she said it today, calling for a 25% reduction in Canada, which is way more than what they're talking about. And of course, as you know, they never met the Kyoto Accord, even the small things with the Kyoto Accord. Well, a 50% reduction means a complete transformation of the society. You know, but it's good to have it there, whether or not you think it's realistic or not. It's good to have it as a demand that's coming from the global south, that's coming from indigenous people. Really what we need to do. Maybe we can't do it, but it's a great goal. You know, it's like equality for women, right? Like we're pretty far from equality for women. But we fought for it. We got a long way there, right? You have to have a vision of what you're fighting for. So that's a Cochabamba Declaration, and I hope I have... I don't have enough pamphlets, but there's a pamphlet on it. It's all over the internet. You shouldn't have trouble there. And if you want to go into it in more detail, there is a teach-in called Building a Global Movement for Climate Justice on the 13th of November. We're having a guest from Bolivia in Toronto at the Sid Smith Hall at U of T. And I have these, you can come see me, I have these pamphlets. So if you're interested in studying more, because it's quite a long declaration. So what are the actions? The first is to get the UN to adopt the Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth, which the indigenous people have now written. And it's a wonderful document. And it's basically that we should have a UN Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth. That we should say what the rights of Mother Earth are, the right to survive, the right to... for its creatures to survive and so on, but also what the responsibility of those of us that live on Mother Earth is to protect her. It's a wonderful, really beautiful document. I don't have time to get into it here. Support for an international climate justice tribunal that will actually take action against those governments, corporations, and individuals that violate whatever's agreed to in terms of reducing carbon emissions. Defend human rights, including those of indigenous peoples and climate migrants. And this is really important because if it's, of course, further exploitation is almost all on indigenous lands now. This is very true in Northern Ontario, for example, which is the largest mineral deposits in the world right now is in Northern Ontario. Okay, and the informed and prior consent is central to the UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights, very central to it, and we have to defend that. And then climate migrants. It's estimated that tens of thousands, and we already have climate migrants, but it's going to get worse. You know, migrants from hurricanes, from all kinds of natural disasters that are going to continue and get worse and worse and worse. And those climate migrants have to be welcomed in the global north. We caused the problem that brought them here. The same with economic migrants, in my view. We caused the problem that brought them here. We forced on them an agricultural system that meant they can't feed themselves anymore. So we should welcome them. And now it's part of this declaration that we welcome them. And they propose a global people's referendum in 2011, that it's the people of the world that have to tell the politicians what we want, the action that we want. And so that's in governments, when governments support this referendum, it'll be governments doing it. Otherwise, it'll be people's movements doing it in whatever way we can. So then the question comes, okay, now you're completely overwhelmed, right? Like, there's so much to do. So the question is, what can you do? What can we do here? Because we're already part of the movement. Just that we're here discussing it, we're part of the movement. So there's several things. First of all, you can go to Cancun. There's going to be movement activities that the Mexicans are organizing in Cancun, like there was in Copenhagen. They'll start November 30th, and I think the last date is December 6th. In Cancun, it's not that far. You can take a little holiday as when you go. The Cochabamba Declaration language is already included in the UN Accord. You know how they do those UN Accord? Governments can add language, okay? So the Cochabamba Accord is in the UN Accord that's going to be discussed in Cancun. That means that they have to, you know, what they do, bracket it, vote it down, whatever they're going to do, they have to discuss it. And that's the advantage of having, and when I talked earlier about how do we confront power with this kind of global movement, by having governments who are with us, we can confront power directly in those meetings, like happened in Cancun as well when the delegates walked out, in Copenhagen as well when the delegates walked out, because we have allies among governments. Just like we used to in the women's movement, have allies, some allies, women and journalists or in power who were allied with us, who helped us to reach into the corridors of power. Then I mentioned November 13th, the teach-in in Toronto. December 4th, I didn't have it here, the People's Assembly in Toronto. And I don't know if there's stuff happening here, so people can tell me. December 7th is a global day of action for climate justice. I don't have information on what's happening, but the idea is to have actions all across the country on that day in solidarity with the people who are going to be fighting in Cancun for a better agreement, and to prepare the second People's Summit on Climate Change in 2011. So that's, I'll leave that on there. So that's the immediate action. But the important thing to realize, and that what we're going to be discussing at the teach-in and what you can be discussing, is how to use this global movement to reinforce what you're doing on a local level. Because if we only look at Canada, it seems kind of hopeless, right? We have this government barely even recognize that climate change exists. Now the Green Party is stepping out. We don't really have a political party that's understanding or political system. They don't even talk about it anymore. It's like, oh, geez, we couldn't come to an agreement in Copenhagen, so we'll forget about that now and go on to something else. That's how they're acting, like that climate, because they couldn't come to an agreement, that the climate crisis isn't a crisis anymore. And we know better than that. So you can get kind of demoralized living here in North America, especially in Canada, around these issues. But if we're linked to the global movement, if we understand that everything we do here to fight our own government, not only to clean up their act in terms of Canada, but to help other countries to clean up their acts, to finance other countries, there's a real program in this Cochabamba Declaration that we can all get behind. And the other thing is, we have the tar sands. And there's a big campaign for a moratorium on the tar sands. And that we should be fighting for. It is revolting what's happening in the tar sands. And even the media is starting to see it. You know, it's terrible. Terrible. And the tar sands, which is probably the symbol of what we shouldn't be doing, is happening here in Canada, so we have a special responsibility. So, you know, when I started in the women's movement, we never imagined how the world would change as a result of what we were doing. We just knew that we had to do it. Each of us knew that we had to fight to change our status. And the same thing is true now in the struggle for climate justice. We might not see, some of us were older, we might not see the final result in the transformation. But what we know is this is the battle of our lives. This is the battle of our lives. Everything we do, and you don't have to put aside your issue, because your issue is this issue. That's the point I'm trying to make. that we link them all. I have never been an environmentalist. Never. You know, that was somebody else's battle. And, you know, I'm a feminist, a social justice activist, and all of that I can bring into this struggle. And so I want to say that I have a lot of hope around what's happening. I have a lot of confidence in the Bolivians and their leadership around this. And leaders. So I guess what I want to say is we can transform society. We can transform the culture. We can transform. I think the political system will be the last to go myself now. I used to think it was what we had to tackle first, but now I think it'll be the last to go. We can make these transformations. We just have to commit to doing it. Thank you very much.
We have another reason to celebrate tonight. And I'm going to invite newly elected Councillor Brenda Johnson for Ward 11 to thank the Speaker.
When you hear about all the activism that's going on in the world, all you have to take a look at is Hamilton, all the activism going on here. Not to mention the Red Hill, but we've done a lot of work in our schools, getting their garbage input down. Take a look at our fruit tree project and our Eat Local projects. And we've got a lot to be proud of. So even though it's not on a global issue, but we've done a lot of work. One of the things that I wanted to do, first of all, was to thank Judy for coming tonight. On behalf of everybody here, of Spirit of the Red Hill, Friends of the Red Hill, thank you so much. It was very inspiring to listen to all this. It was great. The municipal government that I've now just been a brand new member of the family. Well, I think one of the first things that happened when my phone started ringing was like 90 lobbyists were calling me and saying, I'm your new friend now. But one of the things I really wanted to push was we need to take a look at why businesses are not coming to Hamilton. Is it our image? Because it's certainly not because of lack of land. So why are we blowing out 3,000 acres of agricultural lands around the airport to bring in businesses? So let's take a serious look at that, because we don't want to lose the food source closest to us. And why are we bringing it in from Chile, South America, and California? So this is what's so exciting for me, is that I get to work on the inside now, and I'm going to be relying a lot of the experts that are in this room to help me out with that. So it's $24.95. Make sure you pick one up at the lobby on your way out. And again, thanks so much, Judy. It was wonderful. Thanks again.
Before we get to the question period, because I know Judy is ready to answer some questions, we have some donation baskets out there. I just want to tell you a little bit about those donation baskets. Every year we try to direct our donations towards a significant struggle in this community. And Brenda just mentioned the significant struggle in this community at this point in terms of protecting our food security, dealing with climate change, and protecting green spaces in our community. Our city council just recently has decided to go ahead with the concept, call it Aerotropolis. 3,000 acres of farmland, over 4,500 acres total being added to the urban boundary to enrich the speculators who have speculated on it under the guise that this is going to produce jobs. And, of course, it means also the continuing abandonment of the existing industrial zones that have been left to rot along the bayfront. So we are directing our donations tonight to two groups who have committed to appealing to the Ontario Municipal Board this decision. The groups are the Hamiltonians for Progressive Development and Environment Hamilton. So when you see those donation baskets, that's where the money is going tonight, and I hope that you'll be generous. Thanks very much.
This is my own thing, is that on Thursday night, and again in Toronto, I apologize, but you may know that 1,100 people were arrested during the G20, 250 remain under charges, and there's an estimated $400,000 in legal fees. So the first big fundraiser is with Naomi Klein and Hawksley Workman in Toronto on November 11th. And there's flyers and there's a poster out there if you're interested in it. It's got the details. You can order the tickets online. It would be great if people could contribute. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that.
I'm wondering if you know about the 13 Indigenous grandmothers from around the world. The book is available too, and these are women who have come together as varied points as South America, Nepal, Japan, Indigenous women who have been told through their oral traditions that this was going to happen.
Redefining Radio. Syncopal Radio.